Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That has rarely been more the case than with respect to today's program, in which we're going to spend a full hour doing a deep dive on the threat we are facing from communist China with one of the country's preeminent experts on the subject, Richard Fisher. Rick Fisher is a senior fellow specializing in Asian military affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He's also president of Pacific Strategies, Inc. He is the author of a number of books, including most recently China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. He has served, among other things, in the Heritage Foundation and as a consultant to the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. Rick Fisher, it is so good to have you back. Welcome. Thank you for taking a full hour with us to explore in detail the area that you specialize in terms of the threat we're facing from China.
Frank, thank you for having me and for all of your work in focusing this country on the various threats we face.
Well, it's the purpose of this program, and it's made possible by the help of people like yourself. So thank you for giving your time so graciously. Rick, I want to set the stage for what will be mostly a conversation about the military buildup and the threats associated with it from China under Xi Jinping. But before we do that, I thought we might set the stage. Of course, we're having this conversation on the day that the so-called trade war has formally been launched with President Trump's promised imposition of substantial tariffs on Chinese imports, the Chinese retaliating in similar measure. And before we get into all of the various aspects of the China threat, let's talk a little bit about the history, if we can, of what has been called unrestricted warfare the Chinese have been waging against this country at least since 1999. Give us that context, if you would, Rick.
Frank, China, of course, as almost all of your listeners understand and have known, has been dominated, ruled by the Chinese Communist Party since the victory of Mao Zedong's revolution in 1949. This Communist Party, because it is a totalitarian structure, a Leninist totalitarian structure, has the freedom to do things that are very difficult to do in a democracy, such as roll out plans for world domination. Mao, as we know from a few good recent history accounts, definitely had aspirations for global leadership of the communist movement and placing China back in what many Chinese view as China's right place in the world, as the center under heaven and the center of authority and the arbiter of broad international relations. This latter goal has been embraced by subsequent generations of leaders of the Chinese Communist Party. And under Xi Jinping, this dream is being realized. Actual power is being created that China has been deploying, yes, most vigorously since the Tiananmen massacre, for many reasons, not the least of which is that China wants to shape a world that is conducive to the survival of the Chinese Communist Party dictatorship. And that requires that the world follow all Chinese diktat regarding Taiwan. And once the Chinese communist government has another country on that hook, it becomes a wedge by which the Chinese then demand compliance with many other demands that are in the interest of preserving the power of the Chinese Communist Party, but are couched in terms of following or obeying the sensitivities of the Chinese people. So since 1999, China has been practicing not just a kind of unrestricted warfare, but also a kind of comprehensive coercion that melds economic, political, propaganda, and now increasingly military means to achieve its goals.
Yeah. I want to come to that last point, of course, with you in a moment, Rick Fisher. But just to stay with the unrestricted warfare theme, we've seen, of course, predatory, some have called it mercantilistic, even colonial trade practices. We've seen the use of technology theft. We've seen, as you mentioned, influence operations of various kinds. The debt trap now is much in play, it seems, of getting, as you say, these nations, many of them poor third world nations, on the hook, and then making loans that can't be repaid, and then extorting those countries to surrender resources or facilities or bases and the like. Rick, this is all, it seems, coming under the rubric of the China dream that the current Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, has embraced. Talk a little bit about the China dream and whether, in fact, it is a nightmare for just about everybody else.
Well, Frank, you're absolutely right about that. It is a nightmare for everybody else. The China dream, in its essence, requires the restoration of Chinese global primacy so that it is China, not the West, not the democracies, that are writing the rules and then enforcing them. That is essentially the Chinese dream.
Yeah, this is unfortunately, again, born of a long-standing ambition on the part of the Chinese, going back to Mao's time, and Xi Jinping has made no secret of his admiration for Mao and his desire to replicate, I think, his concentration of power and his ability at that time mostly aspired to project it elsewhere. Rick, I wanted to ask you very quickly, and we're going to have to pause in just a moment, but to start the conversation about the Belt and Road Initiative as a vehicle for getting these folks on the hook, if you will, and extorting them. Could you just talk quickly about that?
Well, yes. It got underway in, I believe, 2015 as what is now the premier Chinese vehicle for projecting economic power via what some eventually estimate will amount to a $3 trillion mountain of cash that China will be distributing as investments in countries that sign up for the Belt and Road Initiative. And with that will come all kinds of intervention in the affairs of all these countries.
And a lot of infrastructure that will have repercussions beyond the countries, even the regions most immediately affected. We'll talk about that and much more with Richard Fisher. He is a senior fellow in the International Assessment and Strategy Center, and the author most recently of China's Military Modernization, Building for Global, Regional, and Global Reach. We'll do that and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour with Richard Fisher. Rick is one of our duty experts on matters involving China, specifically the military threat that is emerging therefrom. We've been talking in the first segment with Rick about sort of the context, the ambitions, the aspirations of the Chinese government currently under Xi Jinping, but really going back decades to Mao's time, to begin to acquire the means by which to reestablish China as the center of the universe. And Rick, the center of a very vast colonial enterprise is seemingly the next and perhaps most immediate step in that progress. Talk a little bit about, in addition to the Belt and Road Initiative and what that's meaning for Central Asia, for Pakistan, for Africa, for even into Europe, for that matter, the penetration that the Chinese are making in building infrastructure, in achieving the effects of the debt trap, in acquiring power projection capabilities thereby.
Well, Frank, I would dial you back just a second. You're indeed correct to say China's aspirations are galactic, that China wants to be at the center of the universe. A very important part of China's current power projection is to control the Earth-Moon system, to establish a presence on the moon in the 2030s, and because China's space program is controlled by the People's Liberation Army, anything that China does in space will have dual-use implications, including anything it does on the moon. Now, to get back to the bulk of your question, I would point to an event of the last week that kind of crystallizes the Chinese method and aspiration. China has spent the last 20 years building up an economic and then a political power base on the African continent. China is a dominant, if not the dominant, trading partner with most African countries. China is a key source of infrastructure investment, ports, airports, telecommunication hubs, and on and on, mining, agriculture. And as a consequence, most of these governments are feeding out of the hands of Chinese diplomats and officials. When the Chinese want a slight against Taiwan, they get it. When they want a slight against the United States or the West, they usually get that. And the culmination of these decades of Chinese investment happened just last week when the Chinese in Beijing hosted the first China-Africa Defense Forum. Now, in a sense, it was just a big conference, a kind of a junket for these military leaders from across Africa to go to Beijing, give speeches, get a nice honorarium, let their wives go shopping and the such. But it is the Chinese way of consolidating an alliance. It's, you know, it's really not an alliance. It's an agreement that we give you money, we give you things, we make you rich, we make you powerful, and so you come and sit in our feet and sing the same song that we tell you.
It's kind of a patron-client relationship, again, maybe even of a colonial character, and very much dominant. And again, Rick, this translates into tangible benefits for China. It's not just symbolic, is it?
No. As we mentioned earlier, the Belt and Road $3 trillion investment initiative is basically designed to create, as you mentioned, debt trap opportunities, investments that turn out to be turkeys, but because they might be a port or an airfield, the Chinese will eventually simply say, okay, your debt to us is so great that you need to pay us something. And why we have this nice port here. So you need to pay us that port. We own it now. It's ours. We eventually will have our military forces using that facility.
Eventually may be a fairly short time, too. In some cases, it seems as though this is moving on. Notably, I'm thinking of Pakistan and Djibouti with very rapid development. Speaking of rapid development, Rick, again, before we get into some of the military capabilities, I did want to talk with you also about the South China Sea and what the Chinese have been developing there, including now what they've been arming there and the implications of that.
Well, yes, Frank. The South China Sea has been a Chinese target since the 1970s, Well, really, they took control of the Paracels in 1949 and have had the ambition of turning the South China Sea into a Chinese lake since at least that long. And now they're finally doing just that. They've created three large military bases to the south of the Paracels in the Spratly Island group. And those bases are largely finished and now in the process of being armed, first with surface-to-air missiles and anti-ship missiles, and very soon with regiments of combat aircraft and regular stationing of combat ships. These bases are large enough to facilitate an invasion of Palawan Island of the Philippines, or to begin to project comprehensive air and naval force to the south to control the Straits of Malacca or project into the Indian Ocean.
And the theory that these are going to be used essentially to control who has access to those waters and the resources in and under them has been increasingly validated by not only these military moves, but also by the declaratory policy of the Chinese government. If I understand this correctly, Rick Fisher, they are essentially asserting that they will require permission going forward for people transiting those areas on the water or above it, for that matter. Is that right?
Well, the Chinese tactic is very playground bully. I mean, they draw a line, they dare us to cross, we cross, and then it's a double dare. And, you know, pretty soon the big guy is telling the other guy to crawl around on his hands and knees. And that's the process that's going on right now in the South China Sea. The United States is pushing back with freedom of navigation operations, sailing close to some of these Chinese islands. And the Chinese are then using the American action to make an even higher demand, to salami slice even more rapidly their way into actual political control by forcing the United States and then all of our allies to accept more specific Chinese definitions of what they control and what we can do.
The new normal, if you will. Rick, let's start into, as we're in the South China Sea region for the moment, what the Chinese are doing. You've mentioned some of the capabilities that they're deploying onto these man-made islands that they're fortifying. Talk a bit about the Chinese Navy and what it is currently like, its ability to project power specifically in the East and South China Seas, but increasingly at considerable remove from China itself.
Yes, the Chinese Navy, like the Chinese Air Force, for the last 15 years has been in the midst of a transition from the means to achieve regional dominance to the means to achieve global projection. So we now have a Chinese Navy that has increased in size roughly three times in the last 15 years. And these are modern ships, and there are just lots of them. The Chinese have just launched their 41st or 42nd of a very nifty 1,800-ton corvette. They're moving close to 30 of a 4,500-ton frigate, and they've produced close to 20 8,000-ton destroyers, and are now beginning a new class of about 12 to 15,000-ton cruisers. And those will start coming off the line like dumplings. But on top of that, the Chinese are now moving into series production of aircraft carriers. And pretty soon those will be nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. And by the 2030s, the Chinese carrier battle group will be completely nuclear-powered. That is, nuclear-powered carrier, nuclear-powered cruiser, nuclear-powered underway replenishment ship. The Chinese revealed just that concept last December.
Yeah, and again, the principal advantage of that kind of capability, especially in all of the ships in a battle group, is essentially unlimited range, is it not?
Unlimited range and fantastic speed.
And endurance at sea, I guess, is the other key point. So it's as a power projection instrument, it's transformative. And again, Rick, I mean, what you've laid out here is really a painfully thorough and disciplined and patient amassing of capabilities that are impressive in their own right, but the more dramatic in contrast to what the United States Navy has at the moment and will, if all other things are equal, have in the foreseeable future. Rick Fisher is our guest. He is the author most recently of China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. You can find his work at, among other places, the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He is also the president of Pacific Strategies, and we'll be right back with more on his net assessment of the Chinese versus U.S. navies right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our intelligence briefing with Richard Fisher, one of the country's preeminent experts on China's military capabilities and what they might mean for us, is in the house virtually. We're delighted to have him with us, as always. Check out Rick's terrific book, China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach, which is very much the topic we are addressing at the moment. Rick, I asked you before the break to compare and contrast, if you will, what you've just described in terms of this extraordinary buildup of Chinese naval power and the relative capabilities of the U.S. Navy at the moment and for that matter, in prospect.
Well, Frank, the United States has 11 aircraft carriers, and we are hard-pressed to sustain at any time three of them underway. I mean, getting three of them in one place at one time is now a rare event, but we keep at least two underway to meet global commitments in Asia, in the Middle East, or sometimes that shifts to Europe because the Russians are on the march as well, we can't forget. That's our situation, and that's our limitation because of our budgets, our build rate, personnel policies, and logistics support capabilities, and all that. Now, the last 5 years, the Chinese were trying to start a second war over the Falklands Islands. And they almost came to that if it hadn't been for the December 2015 election that saw the end of the Fernandez-Kirchner regime, left-wing regime, highly hawked to the Chinese on in multiple fronts. Now, Argentina will probably elect another leftist regime at some point in the future, and perhaps, if enough of the old officials are around, the idea of rearming to threaten the Falklands again may come to the fore. Well, when that happens, China may be able to send an aircraft carrier battle group to support the Argentines. One, maybe two carriers in our hemisphere. Now, a war does not have to happen. Just enough of a show of force to convince Britain that they should negotiate over the future of the islands instead of fight.
Well, and needless to say, while our power is diminished, the Brits have essentially let everything go. I don't think they would have the capability to project force to the Falklands in anything remotely like what they did, with our help, to be sure, back in the Reagan administration, would they?
But all of our friends in the Southern Cone will be on Argentina's side. So the victory will be not Argentina's, but China's, and all of our former friends, very strategically placed, Chile, Brazil, I mean, to the degree that Brazil is a partner and a friend, they will become increasingly China's partner and friend because of the vast economic investment and commercial power the Chinese have in those countries, now on top of the ability to direct the direction of political military power in their regions as well.
Perhaps winning a war without fighting it, which I think is one of Sun Tzu's very famous admonitions. Rick, in terms of carriers, you've mentioned that we have a considerable inventory of them, but have a hard time getting them to sea. The other thing that I just wanted to draw you out on was what the Chinese have done by way of developing anti-carrier capabilities as part of a larger effort to deny us access to and the freedom to operate in areas like the South China Sea, or for that matter, coming to the rescue of Taiwan. Talk a bit about these ballistic missiles that the Chinese have developed for carrier-killing purposes.
Well, there are many layers, Frank. There are about 70 conventional and nuclear submarines. There are all the ships with long-range anti-ship cruise missiles, the aircraft with anti-ship cruise missiles. These can all be coordinated. But what the Chinese have done over the last 20 years has been to develop a new weapon, basically based on the old American Pershing II initially, which they obtained via espionage. And the Chinese have created intimately guided ballistic missiles for the first time that can hit moving targets at sea, anti-ship ballistic missiles. But in the last 2 years, the Chinese have begun testing an air-launched version of the anti-ship ballistic missile, which comes down at the ship at extremely high speed, Mach 7, Mach 8. It's very difficult to shoot down, defend against. Now there is an air-launched version of the land-launched missiles, and within the next 2 to 3 years, there will be sea-launched anti-ship ballistic missiles as well. So this will not just be a capability that the Chinese can array against the United States over a war over Taiwan or a war in the South China Sea. The Chinese will be able to deploy anti-ship ballistic missiles along with their carrier battle groups to establish dominance and control.
Rick Fisher, I was talking yesterday with our friend Bill Gertz, who has just returned, as you know, from China, where he traveled with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis for conversations at the highest levels of the Chinese government. And Bill reported that one of the features of the conversation that the Secretary of Defense had with the head of the People's Liberation Army was to the effect that you may have all of this fancy gear, but you don't have the kind of battle-hardened experience at sea in particular that we do, and you best not trifle with us or bring upon yourself a world of hurt. What would you expect is the Chinese view of that? They've indeed been building up this capability for some time, but thank God they have not actually used it in combat to date. Is that a real limitation on their abilities as you see it?
Yes and no. And the Chinese understand this, and I imagine that there was professional acknowledgement of Mattis's retort, but in their minds, the Chinese are basically saying something else as well, like, look, Mattis, if we launch the massive offensive first, then we catch you by surprise and you lose. So we don't have to have all that experience if we achieve real and massive surprise.
Which would seem to be something very much part of their doctrine. I've heard for years, Rick Fisher, about something called Assassin's Mace. And I've never been quite clear whether that's a specific capability or it's simply this idea of using a stealthy first strike to achieve a decisive advantage of the kind you're talking about. Could you clarify that?
Well, Assassin's Mace is really a term from ancient Chinese statecraft, thousands of years old, that refers to not just the right weapon, but the right weapon at the right time hitting at exactly the right place on the target. Something that, let's say, defeats the cavalry charge by taking out the right hoof of the horse, or something of that such, attacking a weakness that then causes an avalanche of failure that leads to defeat.
But surprise is a feature of it, is it not? At least going back to ancient Chinese lore.
Yes, it's probably the most important aspect. It's a weapon a system, a method developed in secret, and the enemy has no idea that it exists until he is dying from it.
Rick, speaking of surprise and being in the dark about exactly the Chinese capabilities, let me pivot to their nuclear forces. You do a fantastic job of trying to assess and bring to public light here in the United States what there is to know about what they're up to. But I think you would be among the first to agree that they've done a pretty good job of concealing the full scope and capabilities of their nuclear forces. We know they've been modernizing them, but how would you characterize them today in terms of both quality and numbers? And why is it so hard for us to have a good fix on their actual abilities?
First and foremost, because the Chinese conceal, the Chinese lie, and the Chinese make very clear that they have no interest whatsoever in transparency regarding strategic nuclear capabilities, a kind of tradition, if you will, established between the former Soviet Union and the United States as they move through successive rounds of nuclear weapons arms control. Indeed, you know, the Russians were cheating everywhere all the time, but they kind of kept within a certain box of capabilities that was part of the negotiations. The Chinese have no interest in this whatsoever, and in fact want us to know the least amount of information in order to sustain the highest amount of anxiety about their strategic capabilities. And it is my contention that even within our intelligence community that we don't know what they have. You know, for example, the public announced number of nuclear warheads that is advanced by groups like the Federation of American Scientists or SIPRI out in Sweden, something that is mouthed not quite by the American government, but by other governments, is this idea that the Chinese have this incredibly small number of warheads, 220, 240, whatever the name is. It's repeated ad nauseum. But if you just simply look at the number of ICBMs and SLBMs that flow from what we know about a unit size for an ICBM or an SLBM force and calculate the number of warheads that we can estimate that the Chinese have, in ICBMs alone, the number approaches 300 warheads. And there's some debate over whether ICBM units have a missile reload capability. Well, they definitely have a capability, but is that Chinese practice?
Rick, we have to pause for one last time. I want to come back to this. We'll be talking with Rick Fisher about that and much more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the fourth and final installment of this very important intelligence briefing about one of the greatest perils we face in our time's phase of this war for the free world, namely the threat posed by communist China. And as we've been discussing with Rick Fisher, for many years, it's been a threat that has been manifesting itself as an unrestricted warfare of various kinds, short of kinetic action. But increasingly, the Chinese, as Rick Fisher knows better than just about anybody else in America, have put into place the capabilities to have it go kinetic, and perhaps decisively so. Rick is a senior fellow at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. His most recent book is China's Military Modernization. And Rick, we were talking about the lowballing of American estimates of Chinese nuclear forces. And I did want you to talk a little bit about one of the basing modes, it appears, for potentially very large numbers of Chinese ballistic missiles, land-based ballistic missiles, namely the so-called underground Great Wall of China. Tell us about that.
Yes, this has been a Chinese project since the 1970s. The Chinese have developed a world-class competence in underground tunneling and have constructed thousands of kilometers, not just of specific tunnels, little racetracks in various places to support ICBM bases, but are now in a position of being able to use a much larger civilian railroad tunnel network and automobile tunnel network to hide ICBMs as well. The Dongfeng 41, a 10 warhead carrying ICBM, currently a road mobile ICBM on a large 16-wheel truck, will soon have a railroad based equivalent. So the underground Great Wall, roughly estimated, between 2,000 and 3,000 kilometers today, is going to become many times larger by the access of obtained by the rail-based ICBMs.
So that might be above ground rather than underground.
The tunnels that they'll be hiding in are underground as well.
This is chilling stuff, Rick, and I don't want to cut that part of the conversation short because we haven't talked about their submarine building operations, the large numbers of missile-wielding submarines, some of which are based in a mountain off the Chinese coast, and so much more. But I did want to turn back to something you alluded to earlier, Rick, because you've been warning of it for some time. And I think until very recently, at least, it hasn't been getting anything remotely like the attention it deserves, even from our government, let alone from the American people. And that is this ambition, as you put it, I think this is the Chinese expression, actually, of dominating, they have in mind, they will dominate the so-called Earth-Moon system. Talk about what that means strategically first, Rick, and then what they're doing to actually translate that aspiration into reality.
Well, the Chinese long ago decided that the key to winning war on Earth was controlling low Earth orbit, especially when fighting an adversary like the United States, which is highly dependent on intelligence, surveillance, and communications and electronic warfare assets based in low Earth orbit. Now, in order to control low Earth orbit, you have to control medium Earth orbit and high Earth orbit. And one of the best places to begin to do that is the moon. Now, there are many who suggest that, no, that is not the case. The moon is a very difficult, very expensive place to operate, and it's just not worth the effort. But the United States and the Soviets have been at various times thinking about moon dominance since the late 1950s. The Chinese, for good or for bad, well, for bad, really, have decided, okay, we have to do this. And their ambition is to start populating the moon by the 2030s. Now, two forces have emerged in the last year, couple of years, that could save us. The first one is the space entrepreneur, like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, if you will, people who are investing in these very large, very economical rockets that promise to slash the cost of getting to the moon and then to Mars. These individuals have the potential of giving the United States a 10-year head start on the Chinese in terms of creating an infrastructure on the moon and then the Mars and at the Lagrangian points that could successfully deter China and Russia. But the second force to come on the scene is President Donald Trump, who has made the inspired decision that, okay, all of this hoo-ha about peace and space is over. We have real security interests. We have to defend our people, and to do that, we need a space force. And in 25 years, I doubt there will be anyone who will not be grateful that we have a space force.
Yeah, I think it is potentially one of the most important legacies of the Trump administration, if it is in fact translated into real capabilities of the United States to protect our interests in space. The president spoke about it just yesterday out in Montana, very, very much, I think, underlining the importance that he assigns to this, in particular, his insistence that this be a separate service of the United States military. And it seems as though that's all the more appropriate in light of what you've been sharing with us, Rick, about China's space aspirations, both to control space and to operate offensively from it. We have to have a space force, so, among other things, to deal with that threat. Let me turn finally, Rick, to something that is implied in much of what you've said, but I always think it's important to emphasize because it underscores not simply what China is today, but what it aspires to be in the future. And this takes us back to some of your initial comments about the ambitions of the Chinese over many decades. But discuss, if you would, a bit, the size of the industrial base that the Chinese have put into place to support the, well, for starters, let's say, the fleet that they are now amassing, the shipbuilding capabilities, both commercial and military, dual use, if you will, capabilities, Rick Fisher. And again, what that might portend in terms of future builds and capabilities as well.
Well, the Chinese will dedicate two shipyards to building aircraft carriers. And they have many shipyards that are capable of building combat ships, two shipyards capable of building non-nuclear submarines, one shipyard building nuclear submarines. And they're on a roll. You know, they have two major combat three major combat aircraft producing companies, one focused on bombers and transports, two focused on fighters and other combat aircraft, and a plethora of companies devoted to helicopters, and hundreds of companies devoted to unmanned systems and technologies. And they're very focused on the future. They've just created something called the Strategic Support Force. This will be their leader in combining space combat capabilities with vast information and cyber warfare capabilities, combined with vast intelligence gathering capabilities, big data gathering and manipulation capabilities. This is something that we have barely started to get our heads around on in the United States, but the Chinese have already decided that this is going to be the sixth generation of warfare, and that whatever it becomes, they're going to be the leaders.
You know, Rick, people listening to you might say, oh, Rick Fisher thinks the Chinese are 10 feet tall. How would you respond to the suggestion that you are overstating the power that the Chinese are amassing at the moment?
Well, read my footnotes. I mean, I make my projections based on what I read on the Chinese web, what I read in their journals, and what the Chinese actually tell me at military exhibitions around the world. I track what they're selling, the capabilities of their weapons, and that's the kind of Chinese language that I speak. I mean, the Chinese aren't going to tell us what they're going to do. They're not going to tell us their doctrine, their strategy. We really have to focus on what they have, what they're building, what they tell us they're building, and project outwards. And that's what I do.
You do it better than anybody else I know. Rick Fisher, I appreciate so much your visiting with us from time to time. I especially value these long-form conversations because it allows us to get into considerable detail on the issues that you follow so closely. Rick, we will hopefully have you back very soon. In the meantime, keep up the good work. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again soon as well, Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.